So the first talk was trying to give you intuition for when L1 works and when it doesn't. And in the second, I'll give you very precise statements about exactly when it doesn't, when it does and when it doesn't, quantitative statements instead of these conceptual statements. But before jumping into that, I thought it might be interesting to make a quick note about what happens when you're not solving the L1 equality, but let's say you're solving minimized over X subject to the 2 norm being less than or equal to some tolerance. Okay. All right, so if you're solving this problem, then what's happening with the geometry here? So you have your point B, and then you're saying, well, draw a sphere around that of size tolerance, and then grow out the convex hull, and then let that sphere intersect. Okay? So if you're thinking of a noisy case, you could be talking about the point could be anywhere on the sphere that this could intersect, or you could think about it more deterministically as just having the front, the front of that face there. Now, what happens if you change this norm not to be the 2 norm? Well, then it's not a sphere that you put around the point B, it's some other shape, and as long as that shape isn't strange in its geometry, so it's relatively smooth, then you will get the same sort of effect. You will run into the face, which is most in the direction that's coming out and hitting that object, that lower dimensional object. And what happens is, if you start out with, let's say you started out with tolerance, which was equal to the norm of B minus epsilon, in this case, then what does this sphere look like? Well, it's huge, right? So the sphere is so large that it almost hits the origin. So you start with the polytope being very small and you grow it out, but you can only grow it a very, very small amount. So you grow the convex hull of alpha ACN until it runs into this, and what will happen is you will get a with high probability, a one-term solution. Well, why will you get a one-term solution? Well, because geometrically, what's happened is, so you have 2 points, you have 0, and then you have B, and by doing this, in terms of the polytope which you're growing, it will view this object, the sphere, as essentially being a straight line. Same thing as if it's a wall. And then the polytope, which is your jagged object here, will hit with 1 point for the vertex, and that will give you one non-zero entry. And then what happens is if you shrink this ball in, then it will fall from a simple vertex onto a two-term solution, and then onto a three-term and a four-term, and you can see geometrically how this ball shrinking has the effect of falling onto a higher and higher dimensional face as it goes through. And you can see from that that essentially you're not going to be replacing entries. Right? If you had ones and non-zero that you added in, it's not going to throw that out and add in a new one. So in some sense, the behavior of this kind of an algorithm, when you decrease tolerance from being something like this down to zero, is not unlike a greedy algorithm, where each time it adds in one new non-zero. The real fundamental difference isn't that it isn't the sequentialness, so it's sequential, it's very similar to greedy, it's that it doesn't have this orthogonal projection. So it's allowing you to rebalance the weights that would be in your residual for a greedy algorithm essentially on the fly is more or less what's going on. All right. So let's talk about this question I posed up there. So we come up with an ensemble for our matrix. So we're looking at A being Gaussian. And then we want to know exactly for which A, little n, and big N, we will get the sparsest solution. So when does the L1 solution give you the sparsest solution, the L0 solution? Okay, well, let's first of all parameterize the space of these variables. So we have K, which is less than little n, which is less than big N. So it's quite natural to look at this parameterization over little n versus little n over big N. Each of these variables will be in 0, 1. So this is in your 0, 1 squared. And what we're asking is, for what domain in this square, if you pick a point, will it work? Will the L1 algorithm give you the partial solution? Now, if you think about the kind of results you've seen before that said need k less than or equal to less than tilde n over log of n, something like this, let's say log big N, what would be the portrait here? What would happen to your phase plot? Well, if you divide over by the little n, then you would say that this parameter needs to be less than something like 1 over log n, which would mean that if you let n become large, this phase plot would be flat. It would be the bottom there. So then this wouldn't be the correct scaling. But it turns out for the Gaussian case, this is actually the correct scaling. And in fact, this log factor is actually not there in some sense. It is there and it's not. I'll explain why it's where it's there and where it's not there. So for the Gaussian case, we don't need that. Actually, for the Gaussian case, what we can prove is that there are formulas for, and I'll state them briefly at the end, for what is the difference between the number of k faces of a polytope and the expected number of faces of k faces of a projected polytope. There's a formula for this. It's rather nasty. What we do here is we try to bound this. So what is this statement? This is looking at how many of the faces you lose, right? And we know that for every face you lose, that's a solution, that's a support set, right? A face is a support set of non-zero entries. For each face that you lose, that's a support set for an x, which L1 will not recover. So we want to lose zero faces, if we can, for as high a k as possible. So this is the term that we're interested in. Now, we're interested in only very particular polytope here, and that is the cross polytope. We can take a look at other polytopes, and that would be an interesting problem. We want to bound this. So here's what we do. We bound this by polynomial in n, okay, so n to some power, multiplied by an exponential factor. Upper bound. Similar lower bound exists. The lower bound, here, let me put with only pi n changes. So if you want, you can actually think of this as giving you a really an estimate for exactly how many faces are being lost, at least the exponential character of how many faces are being lost. Now, let's come up with, just to simplify the notation, let's call this rho and delta. So we're defining rho to be given by k over little n, and delta to be given by little n over big N. It turns out that this function here is given entirely in terms of these ratios. So here's what we look for. K fact, what we're interested in is the zero level curve. So find function in terms of delta, let's call this an s down here, so that this is actually equal to zero. It turns out that for rho, which is less than rho s, we have rho s of rho delta, which is in fact less than zero. And if rho is greater than rho s, then this is in fact greater than zero. Well, what does that mean? So, if we have rho, which is less than this parameter, then this will be negative. And as n grows, so asymptotically, we know that we're not going to lose any faces, because no matter the polynomial here, this will in fact be driven arbitrarily down to zero. So you will not lose any faces. However, if you're above that threshold, then this will grow exponentially. And for the lower bound, which means that we know that we will in fact lose some, we will in fact lose exponentially many. Does that make sense? Now, it turns out that this curve doesn't have a log factor. So here's the curve down here, and what that says is if you fix this ratio of little n over big N, so there's, for instance, rho s delta, we know that for k, which is less than n times rho s. Now we should go a little less, right? Because we don't know exactly what happens at that exactly at that level curve, the zero level curve, but slightly below, we know that it will be negative. So if we go slightly below that level curve, then L1 will recover L0. And it will cover L0 because we know that we won't lose any faces. And in fact, as n goes to infinity, then will not lose any faces. So what does that mean for L1 recovery algorithms, if it doesn't lose any faces? And that means it doesn't care what the support set is. Now, first of all, L1 minimization doesn't care what the entry, the values of the non-zero entries are. As long, well, it may care about the sign, but it doesn't care the value other than the sign. It just cares what the support set is, which ones are zero and which ones are not zero, because that tells you what face you're talking about, and we only care about whether the face falls interior or stays exterior, right? So if we know that we don't lose any faces, then there isn't any support set where it won't work. So this is a regime where, with high probability on your selection of A, I probably write that down. Recover the sparsest solution for all x. Now this is a limiting result. This is as n goes to infinity. Okay? That makes sense. So if you look at this plot and you pick a ratio of little n over big N, say here, being a half, okay, you go up, you get a constant value. That value here is, say, 0.12. What that would tell you is that as long as your number of measurements are greater than 0.12 times 1 over 0.12 times little n, or little n number of measurements is greater than the sparsity divided by 0.12, so here, then you would recover the sparse solution. So you need not a log factor, but exactly just a constant of proportionality larger than the information content. So n is a constant greater than k.
Does it know that then rho is greater than constant, then you really do lose these cases? I mean, this is
yes.
What you said was an upper bound.
Yes, but there is a lower bound as well. The only thing that changes isn't the exponent, but it's just the polynomial factor. So it has the same value here, but the polynomial changes. So I think for the upper bound, the polynomial is like n to the 3/2, 3.5, and for the lower bound, it's something like n. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, where is this log factor? So we've talked about this log factor some. Where is it? Well, it is there. In some sense, it's here. If you notice, this curve is diving down toward zero. So, what happens here in that regime? And is that regime of interest? Well, certainly it is. Because in compressed sensing, really what we want is little n to possibly be much smaller than big N. So let's see, where should I erase? For log of big N over little n going to zero. Goes to 1 over 2 log of big N times the square root of pi over little n. Maybe that's not clear. Let's call that pi to the half over little n. Okay. So it's delta inverse times the square root of pi. Okay. So it does have the log factor, right? So here you would have n over log n. Okay. But notice it's, first of all, the constant is quite reasonable. It's only 2. And second of all, this log isn't just log big N, but it's in fact log of big N over little n, which is even better than if you were to have, say, log of big N over k. Make sense? Now, this is quite a strong statement, saying that L1 regularization will work for all x. What is, for applications, maybe a more interesting case would be not requiring that the number of faces that you lose in expectation is driven down to zero, but just that it's very, very small. Okay? Maybe it's okay if you lose a few. Well, why is it okay? Well, because the number of faces that you started with is exponentially larger. So you can lose quite a few and still have it work exponentially often. In fact, you can lose exponentially many as long as the order of that exponent is smaller than the order of how many faces you had to begin with. So rather than a statement quite like this, we come up with a similar sort of thing. Again, we'll have upper and lower bounds where we want that the so we just divided the number of k faces of Cn, k faces of A Cn divided by Cn. We want this to be exponentially small. And there is, again, a curve. It's not the same curve. Put a W there. And again, we play the same game. For that particular curve, we look for the level set where it's equal to zero. rho w of delta, where psi w of now, here the results are a little bit different. So first of all, we do know that for rho, which is less than rho w, this is in fact less than zero. Okay. So if you go just a little bit below, then you do get a negative exponent up there. And as you drive into infinity, it does go to zero. However, it doesn't change sign. To change sign? Well, because we're looking at the fraction of how many you lost. We're never going to get this so that you lose an exponentially large fraction, because then you could lose more than you started with, which you can't, right? So in fact, the best that you can hope for is that this will in fact level off to zero. So this does in fact happen. But for rho, which is greater than rho w, you do lose a non-vanishing fraction of faces. Okay. So you can make it arbitrarily small. Here we want to make the number, the fraction that you lose arbitrarily small. If you go above that, you cannot. Okay. So we have a similar statement here. We put W, and the curve changes quite dramatically. In fact, something quite interesting happens. It actually goes up to 1 in the corner. Now, what is the significance of this? Okay, again, we have a constant proportionality, which is as good as you can get. It doesn't have the log factor for a fixed ratio of little n over big N. Right? If you fix that ratio, say a half, you again get another constant. But quite interestingly, this breaks beyond the threshold, which is what is the best one can get for what is true neighborliness. So if you wanted to maintain all of the faces, it's known that one cannot go beyond little n over 3, so essentially a third. So the red curve could not possibly exceed a third, but if you're willing to lose some of the faces, it definitely exceeds a third, and in fact, it exceeds a third at what is actually quite a modest value of that ratio of little n over big N. Okay, now, so this is good. This says that the OMP, that the L1 regularization is working very, very well. It has a high probability of success. We can see that we're losing exponentially few, which is nice. There's two expectations. So here, the statement would go like this. With high probability on A, L1 would recover L0 for most, and you can be quite specific about what you mean by most here. You can put in a very precise bound if you want. For most x. And when you say really, you're counting on a finite set, right? Because we don't care what the values of the non-zeros are, we just care about the support set. So really it's a discrete set that you're counting over.
That many.
Okay. Now, an advantage of L1 regularization over other techniques is that also you have the ability to bring in additional information that one may have. So we solved the L1 problem, but let's say, for instance, you're solving a problem which is an application. So let's say you're solving magnetic resonance spectroscopy. So here, one of the things that you know is that the transform phi, where compressible, is essentially the molecules. So it's something in the Fourier space that tells you something about the molecule. It tells you what the object is that you're looking at, and the value of x is the concentration. Okay. Well, for this application, you know, for instance, that the entries, they can't be negative. Well, if you know that the entries can't be negative, then why are we worried about all of the faces that have the antipodal pairs, that have plus or minus of the coefficients? Well, instead, you can look at the unit simplex, to look at just one of the quadrants, the quadrant of all of the same sign for the L1 ball. And you can prove the exact same kind of statements, except what one will find is that the thresholds will in fact be better. So what is this saying? Well, if you knew more about the problem you're solving, you can in fact build that information in and do better. One of the problems that people are interested in that no one has worked on, as far as I'm aware, is quantization. So what if you know, for instance, that the entries of x aren't just any old entry, but they come from some discrete set, for instance. If you knew that, you could build in that information as well. You could say, well, the entries in x, so you can build that in, instead of by solving the min of x and L1 subject to ax equals b, you would simply solve. So here, when we know that they're not negative, you solve this, and you add in the constraint that the xi's are greater than or equal to zero. If you knew that it came from a discrete set, you could replace this with even further information. You could put in that, well, if it's non-zero, it has to actually be larger than some small threshold. Geometrically, I think you can see what's happening there. There you're saying that it's not just that it lands anywhere on the face of that polytope, but it has to land on some very special subface given by this smaller set for x. Okay. So we're going quick, but that's good. Now, these results are asymptotic. So these are as n goes to infinity, but one could wonder whether you could get results in the non-asymptotic case. Remember, a lot of the work that Roman was speaking about was what happens in the non-asymptotic case? Can you get bounds then? And the answer is, in fact, yes. And for instance, if you have the success probability that you know that you need, so let's say here you wanted to say 99% success rate, and you know what this polynomial is, then you solve for a new function. Okay. What do you get there? Well, so here is the case where we're looking at the weak threshold. We want it to work 99% of the time. So 99% of the faces survive. At least 99%, could be more. We don't know. and then you look at what happens for different values of little n, and you guarantee that for any n which is larger than one of these, so say for any n greater than 200, we know that at least 99% of the faces will survive with high probability on A. So here would be the curve for the case where you have 99% success rate for n being 200. If you then go up to n being 1,000, you see a curve here. Well, you probably can't. It's very small there. At 5,000, and then as n goes off to infinity, would be this curve. So it does. It has a graceful change. One thing that one should note is, if you talk about n being too small, and you're looking at this ratio here, right? This is the ratio of little n over big N. So let's say that you're at a tenth. So big N is 200. Little n would then be 20. Okay. So we want to be talking about 20-dimensional faces. So then this would be 20. And then we have to look at k, which is going from 1 up to 19. Then you're not talking about high-dimensional geometry anymore when you start getting down into this region. And in fact, one can't say that it will succeed. This curve will actually run into the origin. Simply, it's not zero. It's only when you go off to n being infinity that you get this curve, which is always positive. So when n goes to infinity, then this these curves are strictly greater than zero. Otherwise, they can actually intersect, in which case you lose all information. That doesn't happen for n being very large, but it does for n being quite small. You can also make similar statements about the strong threshold. Instead of having it work all the time, you could talk about, well, we just want it to exist. Say the existence of a k-neighborly face, and there are curves one can come up with. And you can get this because you have a precise understanding for these bounds, both upper and lower bounds. Now, for the weak threshold, one can actually just try this. This is sort of an informative thing to do if you're beginning to get into the field, is essentially grid up this domain. So put a mesh on it. For each value here, if you fix big N, so there we took big N to be, say, 200, okay? So fix big N, then pick a point here, that gives you little n and it gives you k, okay? And then try solving the problem. Try it many times and see how it works. What you'll see is that, at least for the L1, it fits these curves that we showed quite well. One of the things that's really needed is for other algorithms, are there similar curves? How do they behave? It's very easy to just try it out. So if you come up with an algorithm, you want to know sort of how does it compare to other algorithms, you can just mesh up the domain of k, little n, and big N, using this square, 0, 1, square, and try it out. Now, if you do in fact have a log factor, then what you will find is if you increase n, it will only work down there. So the version of that would be, if you had a log factor and you took, so here you fix again, let's say 200, and then you look at a fraction of success, and you plotted so here is little n over big N, then what you would see is that based on the sparsity, it would go from always working for so we take a stripe along here. What you will see is that as you go along one of these stripes, the curve here will go this over to some threshold, and this would be your threshold, rho of delta. And if you don't have a log factor, then this curve will sharpen as you increase n. And increasingly sharpen up to a step function as you let n go to infinity. However, if you have a log factor, that won't happen. And what will happen is this curve will go like this. So that would be 200, 5,000, and will continue to deteriorate down to a flat line here. Okay, so those are some results. how does one get at those kind of results? Well, that was going to be talk three. Let me just give you a quick sketch for what one can run into, but we won't go into the details. I think we're all tired. Not the least of me. So let's see here. Let's take a look at what is happening with this mysterious exponent, because that's really what's controlling everything. We want to understand what that exponent behaves like. Oh, and I believe I forgot to say that this, as delta goes to zero, the rho w, we also know how that behaves. It does have a log factor. It's like 2 log beta over 1. Okay. So, what? How do you compute these values? Appenträger and Schneider worked on polytopes. Out a formula for the expected number of faces that one loses when you apply a random ortho projector. Q is a random A is a random ortho projector. Okay. So you have a polytope Q, and then you apply a random ortho projector to that polytope. Then they can tell you how the number of faces you will lose behaves like. And here it is. So there are three terms. Let's see. Gamma is the external angle. So this is looking at angles between subfaces of the original polytope Q and up to the full polytope Q. So you start down at k dimensions. You look at all low-dimensional faces, starting at k, and compare it to high-dimensional faces. Look at all the faces in between k up to q, going by steps of 2 between these two faces. So this is the external angle of gq, angle between those two faces. And this is, and beta is what's called the internal angle. These both are given by partial spherical volumes. Okay. To give you an idea for one of these, and I think we'll call it good there, they exist. If you want to extend these results to other polytopes, you have to develop similar kinds of things.
What's happening with the common between the beta and the gamma?
Nothing. Sorry. Allow multiplication. Excessive with the commas. So, for instance, this one, if you look at L-dimensional faces between for the L1 ball, this is given by Okay, so these things are computable. They're not a lot of fun, but it can be done. How does one go about computing these things, transforming it into the kind of thing we were looking at before? Well, we want to look at just the exponential behavior. So we take a log everywhere. Find the psi s. Or psi week, take a log, and then focus on behavior proportional to capital N. So how does one do this? Well, transform this. Let's define this to be g of x. And then one can say, bless you. And then you multiply this and you just simply call this to bring this up into the exponent, and then you multiply it by the power, which is 2s. Yes. Then if you take a log factor, you're just looking at the exponential behavior there. And you can bound how these integrals behave by looking at the Gaussians. Squared. And you can bound these things quite straightforwardly from above and below. It's a bit tedious, but it can be done. And that's how one arrives at these sort of exponents. Now, this isn't so easy to do, but it can be done. And if one wants to be able to get results which break beyond these kind of n over log n results and get really very precise constants, this is really the kind of work that has to be done. I think we'll leave it there.